The Southern people are not actually united on anything these days, except the Negro question, Donald Davidson wrote to Allen Tate in October of 1929. Davidson and Tate had been discussing the possible subjects and authors to be included in a symposium defending the rural South against encroaching industrialization and the proponents of the New South. In any such defense of the South, the Negro question would be a crucial issue, especially if Davidson's sense of Southern consensus on race was correct. When Davidson finally agreed to give Robert Penn Warren the assignment on race, he wrote to Warren that, "It's up to you, Red, to prove that Negroes are country folks, born and bred in the briar patch." Thus, the genesis of Warren's contribution to I'll Take My Stand. Two assumptions supported Warren's argument in his essay, The Briar Patch. First, regardless of how blacks came to America or how oppressed they may have been once here, America was the contemporary home of the descendants of the slaves. Both blacks and whites must come to terms with the implications of this fact. Second, blacks and whites share a basic interest in how society develops, and their fates are inextricably linked together. After an argument for vocational education and the development of the professions for blacks, Warren began a more general discussion of the requirements for the development of strong black communities, a topic he approached through a discussion of why educated blacks had moved from the South. Warren noted that the most common reasons for this movement were a lack of opportunity and discrimination, and he collapsed the two issues into the single question of equality. While acknowledging that equality was a complicated question, Warren thought it could be untangled. Warren, optimistically, naively, or disingenuously wrote, quote, the simplest issue, and probably the one on which most people would agree, is that of equal right before the law. This essay was written in 1929. Justice before the law, so often unavailable to the black, is the least he can demand for himself or others can demand for him. Warren underlined the broader social importance of racial equality before the law without spelling out the implications of his comment, quote, the matter of political right carries repercussions which affect almost every relation of the two races. But then he concluded by merely reiterating, the least that can be desired on behalf of the Negro is that any regulation shall apply equitably to both him and to the white man. Warren thought that the only way to avoid racial violence under the conditions of increased industrialization in the South was through the recognition that the fates of the poor white and the Negro are linked in a single tether. The well-being and adjustment of the one depends on that of the other. While labor could attempt to retard the development of black labor through intimidation or violence, or white labor could learn, quote, that color has nothing to do with the true laying of a brick and that the comfort of all involved in the process depends on his recognition and acceptance of that fact. Warren argued that a move toward the land would provide the readiest and probably surest way for the greater number of Negroes to establish themselves. In addition to providing for financial independence, such a move would save blacks from the formalized and impersonal group relations of the city. There was more opportunity for contact between the races in a rural setting, and this contact allowed for the development of personal relations that transcended race. Warren, in fact, maintained that the rural people provides the most satisfactory relationship of the two races which can be found at present. The movement of blacks into agriculture, however, again raised the difficulty of competition between the two races, which again raised the question of racial violence. Warren thought that in a rural setting, the issue was more readily ponderable, but he offered no plan to deal with the type of violence he had emphasized in talking about urban competition. Ultimately, Warren set forth a challenge to Southern whites, and this challenge was intentionally or unintentionally aimed directly at his agrarian brothers. Quote, if the Southern man feels that the agrarian life has a certain irreplaceable value in his society, and if he hopes to maintain its integrity in the face of industrialism or its dignity in the face of agricultural depression, he must find a place for the Negro in his scheme. Warren's essay is not so much an argument for segregation as it is an acceptance of segregation as a given within which action must be taken. Warren certainly accepted the outlines of a segregated society that already existed as the basis for his analysis. Let the Negro sit beneath his own vine and fig tree. Warren accepted the distinction between political discrimination and social discrimination as delineated by the Supreme Court, and therefore he accepted the doctrine of separate but equal as a legitimate rule for social life. That stated, it must be immediately noted that Warren did not simply accept all discriminatory acts as inevitable and legitimate. Warren argued for the absolute importance of equal treatment before the law for blacks, for the importance of black self-sufficiency and control of their own communities. Warren recognized the human equality of blacks, and not just legal equality, when he argued that this Negro community must have such roots as the white community owns. Warren argued that in the marketplace, color was not important for success, but that ability and performance were the keys to economic success. He challenged white laborers to show respect for themselves as men by acknowledging the legal equality of blacks and eschewing violence. He challenged the white intellectual who sought to defend the Southern way of life to find a place for the Negro in his scheme. The essay, in passing, also stressed that legal equality carries repercussions which affect almost every relation of the two races, without delineating those repercussions. While it would be pushing the point to argue that the Briar Patch was a direct attack on the Southern way of life when it came to race relations, it was, in the words of Lewis Rubin, implicitly disruptive of the Southern racial status quo. In the next section of my paper, which I won't go into, I provide a brief summary of the treatment of race in the other contributions to I'll Take My Stand that situate Warren's argument within the context of that entire symposium. Whether one treats I'll Take My Stand as a set of practical proposals for political and social reform or as an expression of moral and artistic vision, it is legitimate to ask if agrarianism has anything of importance to say regarding race relations and racial justice. None of the other authors in I'll Take My Stand sought to meet Warren's challenge to find a place for the Negro in his scheme. As Lewis Rubin observed, generally, the black man in I'll Take My Stand is viewed as a kind of peasant, an element in Southern society fitted to be the hewer of wood and drawer of water, and one that can be accommodated within an agrarian dispensation without too much adjustment. Virginia Rock confirms that most of the writers did not even discuss the Negro and concludes those who did take cognizance of the race question in their essays would not have aroused the ire of Southern traditionalists. I agree with Paul Konkin's observation that the presence of Warren's essay thus early revealed the one-time bomb lurking beneath the seeming consensus in I'll Take My Stand, race. Now I'm going to fast forward a couple of decades to the 1950s and 60s. In his discussion of the prospects for agrarianism, Mark Malvasi takes as exemplars of the generation following on the contributors to I'll Take My Stand, Mel Bradford and Richard M. Weaver. I will conclude this overview of the agrarian position on race by comparing the writings of Weaver and Warren from the 1950s and 60s. At least since Socrates claimed that the polis could be understood as man writ large, political thinkers have been drawing analogies between the body of man and the body politic. So I conclude with a brief discussion of the question of personal and social integration. In an essay entitled Individuality and Modernity, Weaver maintains, quote, "It seems a threshold fact that personality is some kind of integration. The individual whom we regard as having authentic personality appears to possess a center, and everything that he does is in relation to this." Weaver contends that personality is under attack today from a number of directions and that the forces most inimical to personality include assaults on memory, on status, and on privacy. This center that is at the heart of personality is not something given to us, rather, quote, "the fact that one has this kind of center means that one has created something as a result of his effort in living. And it is this something that gives one a defined character or a self." Weaver suggests that man is happiest when he enjoys a kind of equipoise of status and function, or of being and action. One component of the modern attack on personality is the overemphasis or exclusive focus on function or action and the denigration of status or being. Now, status may be either earned or prescriptive. It is clear from Weaver's discussion, I think, that he has earned status in mind when talking of personality. Let me quote his argument at length on this point. "The idea of status," Weaver writes, "while certainly capable of abuse, is an important element in one's psychic well-being. It is natural and it is right for a man to wish to be seen as something more than he is at a random moment. He wishes to be known as an individual, and individuality requires historiosity. If he has by effort and sacrifice won himself a position among men, that position is part of his being. When you touch him, you touch it. When you address him, you are not addressing merely the externals of indifferently preserved flesh. You are addressing the man within who has achieved a state of being." Although I can do little more than point to it here, a coupling of Weaver's understanding of human personality with his defense of cultural freedom provides a solid basis for understanding the importance of regionalism or localism in political and social affairs. In his essay, The Importance of Cultural Freedom, Weaver builds a case for the right of cultural pluralism and the right of cultural freedom. I simply highlight a few of Weaver's most significant claims. First, all cultures are necessarily regional. Second, culture grows from roots more enduring than those of the political state. Third, no government and no ideology which try to cut a people off from its past can be friendly to culture. One could conclude on the basis of Weaver's writings that the core of agrarianism is a defense of the individual personality understood in all of its fullness, which includes its relation both to the past and to its current community. On a few occasions, then, when Weaver turns explicitly to questions of race, however, his robust understanding of personality and cultural pluralism seems to disappear. We could approach this issue through an analysis of Weaver's discussion of black culture in Ideas Have Consequences, but in the time allotted, I will use a blunter instrument provided by Weaver himself, a book review published in National Review in 1957 entitled Integration is Communization. Among the books Weaver reviews is Passive Resistance in South Africa, in which the author, Leo Cooper, quote, notes that communism is there being progressively redefined in racial terms. That is to say, communism is coming to be identified with racial integration. Now, assuming that this to be a correct analysis of the situation, there are a number of ways in which one might proceed. One possible approach would be to argue that as political operatives, communists were cagey enough to look at the easiest targets of interest to promote their agenda. This approach to the question would require that one at least consider the possibility that there were legitimate grievances which were then slyly and amorally exploited by communists to promote their revolution. Weaver seems to reject this possibility when he writes that the blame for this, that is, communism coming to be identified with racial integration, Cooper tries to shift to the apartheid laws themselves. But surely this is artless. Weaver then turns from the book on South Africa to a discussion of the United States in order to apply his argument here. Quote, the communist tactic most aggressively used in this country now is the one hinted at by Mr. Cooper, the approach through the idea of racial collectivism. From the standpoint of communists and their stooges, this strategy has two advantages. First, argument for racial integration can now be presented with a great deal of moral unction. And secondly, the tactical advantage of undermining our historic constitutional structure. Even if American intellectuals and politicians are deceived, Weaver suggests that the common people are not. To them, communists have always signalized its advent by an ostensibly free and natural, but actually self-conscious and tendentiously racial mingling. It strikes me that Weaver's normally careful use of language is lost in this discussion. He writes, quote, integration and communization are, after all, pretty closely synonymous. In the light of what is happening today, the first may be little more than a euphemism for the second. It does not take many steps to get from the integrating of facilities to the communizing of facilities, if the impulse is there. Contrast Weaver with Warren on this point. Remember that the Briar Patch acknowledged that there was a reciprocal relationship between one's self-understanding and one's understanding of others. just as the split between men is a reflection of the split within the individual man. The manner in which one treats others is a reflection of how one understands oneself. In the Briar Patch, Warren argued that if the white man, quote, fails to concede the Negro equal protection, he does not properly respect himself as a man. In the self-interview that concludes Warren's Segregation, the Inner Conflict of the South, the same point is made forcefully. Question: you mean they ought to let the South work out a way to live with the Negro? Answer: I don't think that the problem is to learn to live with the Negro. Question: what is it then? Answer: it is to learn to live with ourselves. Question: what do you mean? Answer: I don't think you can live with yourself when you are humiliating the man next to you. The self-division that Warren explored in Segregation is the result of some failure of to find identity. Identity, in turn, became one of the major lines of investigation followed by Warren in Who Speaks for the Negro? As Warren pushed to understand the identity of the American black, he ultimately pushed beyond that limited identity to see it merge with the question of what it means to be a human being. Warren quoted Robert Watson, a student at Southern University in Baton Rouge, to this effect. Robert Watson: what am I struggling for? I'm struggling for the heights of a man. Regardless, I think that if I reach the heights of a man in a limited all-Negro society, I have not reached the heights of a man by world standards. In Who Speaks for the Negro, Warren came to see the word integration in terms of the split within the individual that is the foundation of the split between men. In contrast to James Baldwin's apocalyptic vision of personal and racial integration, Warren's model for integration as human wholeness was Whitney Young. Young had begun to connect the necessity of making a living with the act of living. Young had come to see life as an element in human fulfillment, not just as an instrumental means to a greater end. This vision of the integrated personality as the foundation for moral responsibility was the key to Warren's hope that the racial split in America could be healed. A truly integrated society will be a reflection of a truly integrated individual. I would argue that Weaver and Warren share many points of agreement in understanding the dynamics of human personality. Each sees the self as a creation of moral choice and action. Each understands that men are not social atoms, but embedded both in a contemporary community and in historical narrative. And each emphasizes the importance of piety as living a grounded moral life. I would suggest, however, that Warren was able to maintain his robust understanding of human personality when he turned to questions of race, but Weaver, for whatever reasons, was not. Warren's challenge in the Briar Patch, a challenge made in 1930 to himself and his fellow agrarians, can be given a more general cast for us today. If the conservative feels that tradition, piety, and liberty have a certain irreplaceable value in his society, and if he hopes to maintain conservatism's integrity in the face of social turbulence, moral disintegration, and political divergence, he must allow a full and free role for people of color in his scheme. This challenge stands before us today, as it has throughout our history as a nation. Should we shirk or ignore this challenge? Our failure should be seen not only as an important political opportunity lost, but would stand as evidence of conservatism's limited moral and spiritual vision.